New York, this is Democracy Now!
I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come in to the United States, including some very bad people.
Just days after Hurricane Dorian ravaged the Bahamas, President Trump sends a message to survivors. Don't try coming to the United States unless you have full documentation. This comes after more than 100 storm survivors were turned away after boarding a ferry bound for Florida. We'll speak to a Florida lawmaker pushing the U.S. to do more to help the people of the Bahamas. The death toll is 50 and expected to soar. We'll go to Mexico, where thousands of African migrants are essentially stranded after being blocked from traveling north to the United States and Canada. Plus, we'll look at the remarkable story of a Palestinian student from a Lebanese refugee camp who made it to Harvard, but then was initially deported from the United States at Logan Airport.
My name is Ismail Ajawi. I'm 17 years old. I scored the highest marks in biology in the South region in the official Lebanese baccalaureate and the 8th overall in Lebanon. I also scored the highest marks in the Brevet examination in the South region and received a scholarship to study biophysics at Harvard University.
After the president of Harvard weighed in, the student was allowed to attend classes, the freshman class at Harvard. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Calls for Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to resign are mounting after reports emerged Monday he threatened to fire staff at NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for pushing back on President Trump's false statements about Hurricane Dorian and its risk to Alabama. On September 1st, Trump incorrectly tweeted Alabama would, quote, most likely be hit much harder than anticipated. The statement was swiftly refuted by the National Weather Service. Last Friday, NOAA issued a statement disavowing the National Weather Service's denial. The Washington Post reported over the weekend NOAA warned its staff not to publicly contradict President Trump's false statements. The agency reportedly sent a similar message after Trump showed a doctored hurricane prediction map last week with a hand-drawn extension added by black marker to include Alabama. NOAA's acting chief scientist told co-workers Friday he's investigating whether the agency's response to President Trump's Dorian tweets constitute a violation of agency policies and ethics. The Commerce Department's Office of Inspector General has also launched an investigation into the matter, according to the New York Times. Meanwhile, National Weather Service Director Louis Uccellini publicly backed NOAA forecasters at a meeting of the National Weather Association Monday for dispelling the falsehoods about Dorian's threat to Alabama. In related news, President Trump threatened Monday to create obstacles for entry for asylum seekers from hurricane-ravaged Bahamas.
But we have to be very careful. Everybody needs totally proper documentation because, the Bahamas had some tremendous problems with people going to the Bahamas that weren't supposed to be there. I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come in to the United States, including some very bad people and some very bad gang members and some very, very bad drug dealers.
Trump's comments contradict those of Acting Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection Mark Morgan, who said just hours earlier the agency was already processing entrants without documentation. This is a humanitarian mission, right? Morgan said to reporters. The death toll in the Bahamas has reached at least 50 people, though expected to soar as thousands are still missing. An estimated 5,000 people have fled the Bahamas since the devastating hurricane. On Sunday, over 100 people seeking asylum in the U.S. were turned away after boarding a ferry bound for Florida. The ferry operator has since apologized for kicking the passengers off the boat. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The British Parliament is officially suspended for the next 5 weeks as the battle over Brexit continued to heat up Monday. Members of Parliament rejected for the second time Prime Minister Boris Johnson's bid to call a snap election in October. Lawmakers opposing the move say measures blocking a no-deal Brexit must first be put into place. Also Monday, a bill to prevent a no-deal Brexit in October received royal assent and was passed into law. Under the law, Boris Johnson will be forced to seek a delay until January 31st. Lawmakers are also directed Johnson to hand over government documents relating to the suspension of Parliament and its plans for a no-deal Brexit. As the official suspension of Parliament started in the early hours of this morning, some lawmakers protested by gathering around House of Commons Speaker John Bercow, holding signs that read "Silenced" and shouting "Shame on you." Speaker John Bercow announced Monday he'll step down either October 31st or at the next election, depending on which comes first. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has warned the worsening climate crisis is the greatest threat to human rights around the world, and the window to fight the catastrophic effects of a heating planet is closing. Bachelet spoke Monday at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland.
WHO expects climate change to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths per year between 2030 and 2050 from malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress alone. In many nations, chaotic weather patterns and other manifestations of our environmental emergency are already reversing major development gains, exacerbating conflict, displacement, and social tension, hampering economic growth, and shaping increasingly harsh inequalities. The world has never seen a threat to human rights of this scope.
Bachelet also sounded the alarm on mounting attacks against environmental and human rights defenders, making particular note of activists in Latin America, as well as Swedish teen Greta Thunberg. Greta recently made the journey to the United States with a zero-emission sailboat to address the upcoming UN Climate Action Summit on June 23rd and the global climate strike on September 20th. She'll then head to Chile for the UN Climate Summit in December. On Friday, Greta Thunberg and students from New York City area took part in the weekly student climate strike in front of UN headquarters.
Even though I have taken a sabbatical year from school, I have said that I am going to demonstrate every Friday, no matter where I am, so that's what I am doing now.
Meanwhile, a group of Amazon employees announced Monday they'd be joining the youth-led climate strike to protest Amazon's environmental policies. In more climate news, the French health ministry said Sunday they've linked nearly 1,500 deaths to the record-breaking heat waves that gripped the country and much of Europe in July. Paraguay's justice ministry has launched an investigation after human remains were found buried beneath a home that once belonged to the former dictator Alfredo Stroessner. He was a staunch U.S. ally who seized power in 1954, ruling Paraguay for 35 years. Human rights groups say his regime murdered or disappeared hundreds of people as part of a campaign of torture and terror against political opponents. Stroessner also provided a haven to several Nazi war criminals, including Dr. Joseph Mengele, known as the Angel of Death at Auschwitz. Bangladesh has imposed a mobile phone blackout on Rohingya refugees, further isolating up to a million displaced people living in refugee camps. By order of the Bangladeshi telecommunications minister, only residents with national identity cards will be allowed to possess local cell phone SIM cards. The order also bars the sale of cell phones in Rohingya refugee camps and will fine telecom companies that violate the order. 2 years ago, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fled to Bangladesh from Burma's Rakhine State after Burmese authorities launched a campaign that the UN has described as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. North Korea has proposed restarting denuclearization talks with the U.S. later this month. Negotiations between the countries stalled in February after Trump walked away from a failed second summit in Hanoi. But in June, Trump visited the demilitarized zone with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, where the two heads of state expressed renewed interest in resuming talks. This comes as North Korea launched two unidentified projectiles over the Sea of Japan Tuesday morning, the eighth such test since July. The CIA extracted a Russian informant in 2017, who provided top-secret intelligence on Russia for decades. This, according to multiple reports, the intelligence included information on Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. The New York Times is reporting the informant helped U.S. intelligence undermine that Russian President Vladimir Putin was directly involved in those efforts in a bid to help Trump win the presidency. CNN reported the decision to extract the informant from Russia was driven by U.S. intelligence concerns that Trump may have leaked classified information that would lead to the revelation of the informant's identity, including during a White House meeting in May 2017 with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The New York Times is reporting President Trump has a deal with Scotland's Prestwick Airport since 2014 to help increase air traffic at the struggling airport in exchange for sending flight crews to his Turnberry resort some 20 miles away. The U.S. Air Force, meanwhile, struck a separate deal with Prestwick Airport to refuel military planes and help arrange local hotel accommodations for flight crews. This arrangement reportedly led to a seven-person Air Force crew en route to Kuwait staying at the Trump Turnberry in March. A federal court in California has reinstated a nationwide injunction against President Trump's ban on most migrants seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. Last month, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals partially rolled back U.S. District Judge John Tiger's initial ruling on Trump's ban, saying it applied only to California and Arizona. But yesterday, Judge Tiger reissued his original injunction. Melissa Crow of the Southern Poverty Law Center said, quote, "With this decision, regardless of where they cross the border, vulnerable individuals and families should be able to seek asylum." Sadly, while this ruling removes a major hurdle, far too many obstacles remain, as this administration's war on asylum seekers appears to know no bounds, they said. In technology news, attorneys general from 48 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico launched an antitrust investigation into Google Monday. This is Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton speaking in Washington, D.C.
Many consumers believe that the internet is free. Certainly, we know from Google's profits of $117 billion that the internet is not free. And this is a company that dominates all aspects of advertising on the internet and searching
Big
on the internet.
Big tech has come under increasing scrutiny as companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook are accused of stifling market competition through their search, social media, and retail practices. Last week, New York's Attorney General Letitia James announced multiple states were launching antitrust probes into Facebook and looking into whether the company endangered consumer data. The Federal Trade Commission, the Justice Department, and the House Judiciary Committee are all also investigating anti-competitive practices in big tech. The White House announced last week the new U.S. Middle East peace envoy will be 30-year-old White House administrative assistant Avi Berkowitz. Berkowitz, who has no foreign policy experience, has been serving as the assistant to senior advisor Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He'll be replacing Jason Greenblatt, Trump's former real estate lawyer, after Greenblatt announced he was resigning last week. Former White House spokeswoman Hope Hicks previously described Berkowitz's duties as, quote, daily logistics like getting coffee and coordinating meetings. And voters in North Carolina's 9th District head to the polls today for a special election, the final uncalled election from last year's midterms. Last November's race was never certified after evidence of voter fraud started to emerge and was linked to Republican Mark Harris's campaign. Harris dropped out of the race in February. Democrat Dan McCready now faces off against pro-Trump Republican Dan Bishop. Trump spoke at a North Carolina rally in support of Bishop Monday night. During his speech, Trump railed against sanctuary cities and made false claims about illegal voting in California. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to viewers and listeners across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with the Bahamas, where thousands remain missing and thousands more have had their lives thrown into disarray since climate-fueled Hurricane Dorian swept through the island nation last week, decimating entire communities and leaving at least 70,000 people homeless. The death toll hit 50 Monday, and it's expected to keep rising exponentially. While search and rescue missions continue, many survivors of the Category 5 storm are now seeking refuge in the United States. At least 4,000 hurricane survivors have traveled to the U.S. since the hurricane hit, but many more are facing a struggle with paperwork and mounting confusion about what's necessary to gain entry.
On Monday, The acting commissioner of CBP, that's Customs and Border Protection, Mark Morgan, said the U.S. is considering extending temporary protected status, known as TPS, to Bahamians, and that he would discuss it with President Trump. Republican Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott of Florida also called on the Trump administration to lift certain visa requirements to speed Bahamians' entry into the U.S. But on Monday, Trump dismissed the idea of easing travel requirements for people from the Bahamas.
But we have to be very careful. Everybody needs totally proper documentation because, the Bahamas had some tremendous problems with people going to the Bahamas that weren't supposed to be there. I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come into the United States, including some very bad people and some very bad gang members and some very, very bad drug dealers. So we are going to be very, very strong in that. Let me just explain. Large sections, believe it or not, of the Bahamas were not hit. And what we're doing is bringing the people to those sections of the Bahamas that have not been hit.
That was President Trump referring to some of the hurricane survivors as very bad people. His comments came just a day after more than 100 people seeking aid and refuge in the United States were turned away after boarding a ferry bound for Florida over the weekend. The passengers, including young families, got on the ship in Freeport, Bahamas on Sunday. But before the boat left shore, those without U.S. travel visas were told to disembark. WSVN reporter Brian Enten reported on the incident from aboard the ferry and spoke to one remaining passenger as the ship left shore.
I think this is terrible. I think they should allow everyone to come into the U.S. They originally said that you can come without a police record and without a visa, and now they're taking that back. That's really ridiculous. That's
awful. How many people do you think had to get off, did you see?
They said 130 people had to come off. 130 people had to come off the ship tonight.
And now we leave?
Now we're leaving them, and it's only like 200 people on the boat now.
The ferry operator, a Spanish company called Baleària, has since apologized for kicking the passengers off the boat. A spokeswoman for the company said the U.S. immigration officials had told them to allow people without visas to board before reversing the decision, saying Bahamians without paperwork would need to leave for the U.S. from Nassau. Customs and Border Protection has blamed the ferry company for the incident. According to the New York Times, U.S. authorities said Monday only travelers arriving by air would be allowed in without visas. Well, for more, we go to Miami, where we're joined by Chevron Jones, Democratic Florida state representative. He is Bahamian-American, has family in the Bahamas. He's been lobbying the Trump administration to waive visa requirements for Bahamians. Representative Jones, thanks so much for joining us on Democracy Now! Can you talk about the situation in the Bahamas now and what you're calling for in terms of Bahamians seeking refuge in the United States?
Thank you so much, and thank you all for bringing light to this very important humanitarian issue. Currently now within the Bahamas, they are still in search and rescue mode. But while being in search and rescue mode, there are individuals who are there who have lost everything, and they are just looking to get back on their feet. And so what we have asked the Trump administration to do is if they can ease the requirements for individuals to come over to the states. As you know, and as you just reported, there have been individuals who were taken off of the ferry because they did not have the correct documentation. But to our understanding, it was not the federal government, but it was the company that made that action. But the company is now saying that the federal government did it. So what we're saying is it doesn't matter who did it. What we're asking is that we all look at this as a humanitarian effort, and we make sure that we get these individuals to a place of safety where their families are until they can get back on their feet.
Well, what were the policies in terms of Bahamians coming to the U.S. Previous to the hurricane? Did they need visas, or what was the, or could they just easily come into the country?
Previously, individuals who were coming over from the Bahamas, all they would need was a valid passport and a clean criminal record. It is not until now where this administration is making it more difficult for those individuals to come over. And so, again, the only thing that individuals needed in past was a valid passport and a clean criminal record. And that was a letter that came from the Bahamian government police department.
And are you asking for the government to extend TPS, or temporary protected status, to Bahamians as a result of the disaster that had struck the islands?
As you know, TPS is usually given for those individuals who are already here in the States. And some of those individuals who are here in the States, they have been affected by this. And so TPS should be granted for those individuals. But for those individuals who are still on the island, the hope is that we will allow them over here, pair them with their family or a sponsor, because there are individuals who desire to take in people from the Bahamas and allow them in their homes until they can get back on their feet.
Can you comment on what President Trump said about very bad people coming from the Bahamas?
Well, there are bad people in the United States. There are bad people in Miami. There are bad people in Florida. There are bad people all over. President Trump can create whatever narrative he wants. But the true reality is this. The true reality is that we have a humanitarian issue that's on our hands, that's dealing with our neighbors. Individuals just don't vacation there. Bahamians practically help build Miami, South Florida, to be exact. And so being that the president of the United States is now saying that there are very bad people in the Bahamas and we should not allow those individuals to come here within the states. We can deal with the bad people. The Bahamian government are dealing with those individuals who are considered bad people. What we are asking is those individuals who have family, who have children, the seniors, the medically needy, those individuals who need to come over here to the states to get back on their feet. Those are the people who we are allowing to come over. But the president creating this narrative that there are bad people in the Bahamas who we do not want here in the states. Truth is, I'm sorry, Mr. President, there are bad people here currently in our country right now. We cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater and consider everybody from the Bahamas bad people, because there are truly people who really just want to get back on their feet, and we should allow that to happen and sit the politics aside just for a moment so we can get these individuals to a place of safety and help these individuals get back to some normalcy in their life.
And Representative Jones, you have family in the Bahamas. How are they faring? And also, could you comment on there have been several reports of conflicts between the Bahamian government and some of the aid groups in terms of how the aid is reaching those who are most in need?
Yes. And thank God my family is they're doing well. We had one cousin who we could not get in contact with, who the search and rescue did find two days ago. And that's my cousin Gibby. And he's now waiting to go over to Nassau with my family. As it pertains to the aid that's actually reaching the individuals and the conflict that's happening, right now, the biggest thing is the Bahamian government and the U.S. Coast Guard having an understanding of with each other in how this aid is supposed to reach the most needy individuals. But that also plays a role into how this humanitarian effort is currently happening in those people who are here in the States who are helping out. I know there are a lot of people who are wanting to help. There are a lot of people who are helping. But we have to make sure that we are working directly with General Mackey and her office, and making sure that what we are sending out to the Bahamas, making sure that it gets into the hands of the right people. As it pertains to the conflict that's happening over within the Bahamas between the Bahamian government and the Coast Guards, and making sure that it's being placed in the hands of the right people, it is my hope that we do not have these inward fights when it comes to making sure people are receiving this aid in which is needed. The Bahamian government, they are accepting of the help that's coming in from the U.S. government, but there has to be an organized movement to make sure that the people who are most needed and most in need, making sure that they get the aid and receive the need that they need to get.
Republican Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott of your state visited the Bahamas last week and have written a letter urging the Trump administration to waive visa requirements for Bahamians fleeing the devastated island. The Florida lawmakers, both Republican, wrote, quote, "Perhaps one of the most basic yet meaningful steps our government can take immediately is to ensure that those who have lost everything, including family members in some instances, are provided the opportunity for shelter and reunification with family in the United States," they said. Representative Chevron Jones, Florida state lawmakers have also written a similar letter. Talk about the support you've received at the state and national level. Has the Trump administration responded directly to you? Are they speaking yet in one voice?
You know, that is a very good question. Considering that Senator Rubio and Senator Scott and myself, we sit on very opposite side of the aisle, especially on a lot of issues. But it's amazing of what has happened over the course of the last few days and how we have been able to join together. Senator Rubio and Senator Scott gets it. They understand that Florida has a deep, deep connection with the Bahamian community. The response that they have given has been amazing. The response that my colleagues in the House have given is amazing. And I don't want to leave out that Governor DeSantis did travel over to the Bahamas also to look at the damages. The response that has come out of the White House is what we just spoke about in the beginning. To rather than the president saying, you know what, Senator Rubio and Senator Scott, you're right. We need to allow those individuals who are medically needed, who are in need, our seniors, our children with families, we need to allow them over here. And let's figure this out as we go, instead of rhetoric and calling out that there are bad people within the country. So the senators, they both have responded. And I believe that they are going to continue pushing. Senator Rubio tweeted out something yesterday to speak about him continuing to push the efforts to make sure that we can get these people to a place of safety. It is my hope that the White House understands the necessity of us making sure that our neighbors are taken care of. That is my hope. And that the president himself would look at this as a humanitarian effort and not look at this as a political push.
And finally, we just have a minute, but what is your understanding of what's happening to the Haitians who live in the Bahamas, especially Abaco Island? Apparently, the community where they live has been destroyed. Many of them had to escape to shelters. If you can talk about the Haitian community in particular in the Bahamas.
Absolutely. The Bahamian community and the Haitian community, all of those individuals who have been affected by the storm, no one should be exempt. Here's the fact. Their lives have been destroyed. I don't care where they've come from. They need help. They need our help. And we need to give it to them.
Chevron Jones, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Democratic Florida State Representative, Bahamian American. When we come back, we'll go to Mexico, where thousands of African migrants are essentially stranded after being blocked from traveling north to the United States and Canada. Stay with us. So my dad in an abolisa, clear one way, so out in an abolisa, fitirida. So my dad in an abolisa, so out in an abolisa, ninemie, jatins in la la. So my dad in an abolisa, clear one way, so out in an abolisa, fitirida. So my dad in an abolisa, so out in an abolisa, ninemie, jantis in la la. Derenin, derenin, da 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 da. Fatoumata Diawara singing here in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see our interview and her songs, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Mexico, where hundreds of African migrants are protesting the country's refusal to grant them transit visas to travel to the United States or Canada, where they want to apply for asylum. For months, thousands of migrants from countries as far away as Angola, Eritrea, Liberia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo have been forced by the Mexican government to stay in the southern state of Chiapas on the Guatemalan border in a permanent state of limbo. Many of the migrants have been sleeping in tent cities, cooking on the streets, and bathing their children in buckets without the promise of shelter, food, or work permits. With President Trump's new restrictions on asylum seekers, including the Remain in Mexico policy, thousands of other African migrants are also stuck at the U.S.-Mexico border.
These conditions have sparked protests in Chiapas, where hundreds of African migrants have been demonstrating outside an immigration office and detention center in Tapachula since mid-August. Many of the protesters have been met with violent repression from Mexican federal police and the National Guard. This is one of the African migrants at a recent protest.
The police are beating all of the people. From the beginning, there was no violence. But the guards hit people with their shields. They are beating all of the Africans. They are beating children. They are beating all of the people here. They don't want to help us. They are saying that they don't want any problems with us, but they are the ones who started beating people. They're insulting people. The military and the federal police threw tear gas at us. I don't know what we are going to do. We don't have good conditions here. We don't have a place to be. We need help. We need help getting out of here. There are comrades who are in the hospital, beaten with a police shield in the head. We are all human beings here. People are mistreated here every day. In there, they are abusing Africans. If they don't want us here, then give us a visa to get out. We don't want to be in Mexico. We cannot be forced to stay in Mexico.
The long waits for African migrants began in June when it was reported that Mexican immigration authorities were ignoring transit visa requests by African and Haitian migrants to legally cross through Mexico. This came 1 month after the Trump administration threatened the Mexican government with tariffs if the government did not decrease migration through Mexico. In response, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador quickly struck a deal with President Trump to increase militarization of Mexico's southern and northern borders and mostly target migrants from Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean for apprehension and deportation.
For African migrants, the journey to Mexico often takes months. They first must cross an ocean to reach South America, then embark on a dangerous trek through the Colombian jungle and multiple Central American borders. For more, we're going to Mexico City to speak with Carolina Jimenez, America's Deputy Director for Research at Amnesty International. Welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out the issue, particularly for African migrants. When people think about migrants on the border of Mexico and the United States, I think they think of, people from the Northern Triangle, but also Mexicans, they rarely think about African migrants. Talk about the crises they're facing and the fact that many of them are not even trying to come into the United States, but trying to get to Canada.
That is correct. Unfortunately, African migration to Latin America in general is a very invisible issue, although in the last few years we have noticed an important increase in the number of Africans coming to Mexico, trying to reach the U.S. As you were very well describing, despite the fact that many of these people are people in need of international protection because they come from countries that are, facing internal armed conflicts and extreme poverty, the Mexican government has basically decided to crack down on these migrants instead of allowing them to transit freely through Mexico as they used to until very recently, until they changed the policy to seek asylum in the U.S. And what we have right now is a situation of hundreds of people basically trapped in southern Mexico, unable to move north to seek asylum in the U.S., living in very, very difficult conditions, in tents, camping outside the detention centers, basically lacking any access to basic services. So sadly, when it comes to extracontinental migration, although the numbers of African migrants
are increasing, we see that basically there is no policy in place to deal with their needs, with their specific demands, and we are very concerned that the situation will only get worse. This is a reality. Many Africans, thousands of Africans, are coming through what is a very, very difficult journey, reach Mexico on their way or trying to reach the U.S., and due to, you know, mainly the Trump administration's pressure on Mexico, the Mexican government is failing to provide these migrants with, you know, safe passages and with regularization processes that could improve their current situation.
Well, Carolina Jimenez, I wanted to ask you, most when we associate in the news African refugees or migrants, it's usually to Europe across the Mediterranean, which is obviously a much shorter trip than this trip that the African migrants who end up in Mexico are taking. Is it your sense that as the European Union has sought to crack down and prevent African migration, that this has had an effect of forcing Africans to take this much longer route across the Atlantic Ocean through South America and up through Central America to try to get to a country that can provide them refuge?
We believe so. Unfortunately, there is a global trend when it comes to, you know, enforcing more restrictive migration policies, and Europe is not an exception. Now, when we compare the data, I mean, if we see the number of African migrants coming into Mexico from January to June 2018, and we see the numbers in 2019 from January to June this year, we see a 20-80% increase in the number of people coming, mainly from Cameroon, the DRC, Angola, Eritrea, etc. So clearly, migrants are you know, forced basically to take much longer and much more dangerous routes to be able to reach safety. So this is a trend that is likely to continue as we see restrictive immigration policies being implemented in Europe, in the U.S., in Australia, etc.
What caused the initial protests in Chiapas?
Until recently, when migrants from Africa came to Mexico, they were given the choice to regularize or to seek asylum in Mexico. And what this implied in practice is that they were given a document, a notice, that allowed them to move freely into Mexico and therefore to travel north. Without any explanation, the Mexican government changed this policy in July this year, clearly due to the pressure they are receiving from the U.S. to crack down on migrants. And now they are forced, basically, to leave Mexico only through Mexico's southern border. This means they have to go to Guatemala if they want to leave Mexico. They are unable to move north. Now, this change in policy obviously, you know, have a negative impact on their plans, on their individual choice to choose the place, you know, where they could seek asylum. And this is what created the situation that you were describing earlier. I mean, they decided to protest. Unfortunately, there were clashes with security forces. What was a peaceful protest became a violent one because there was, you know, there was repression, and they, you know, they couldn't continue the protests. But the change in policy towards African migrants is actually reflective of a broader trend in Mexico's immigration policy, a trend that implies ensuring that migrants that come to Mexico are not able to travel north and seek asylum in the U.S. And this is a very sad situation in which we see one country, in this case Mexico, basically complying with the enforcement policies of another country, the U.S.
I wanted to ask you about that specifically and the policies under President López Obrador, the pressure that the Trump administration has put on López Obrador, and also the expectations that people had that he would have a more enlightened policy when it came to immigration and the immigration crackdown from the U.S. Your sense of what the pressures are on the current Mexican administration and how they're responding?
Well, López Obrador came to power with a promise that he was going to implement humane immigration policies in Mexico. And of course, there were expectations that he will comply with those promises. Unfortunately, due to pressure from the from the U.S. government, something that we all saw in the news in the month of June, when the President Trump basically threatened Mexico with the imposing tariff if Mexico didn't do more enforcement, the narrative that the President Obrador had until then changed, and what has happened is that Mexico has been forced or has actually decided to give in this pressure. Not only to implement a very strong border enforcement, both in the south and in the northern border, and it is known that the government has sent more than 6,000 troops, mainly from members of the National Guard, a new security force that shouldn't be doing any migration management tasks, and also, you know, implementing the so-called Remain in Mexico policy, which implies that people who seek asylum in the U.S. at the border are sent back to Mexico to wait for their applications to be heard. So I think the trend is very clear. I mean, we did have expectations that this new administration will implement more humane, more rights-based migration policies. But the reality is that it's complying with what the Trump administration has requested. And very sadly, migrants and asylum seekers were the bargaining chip of those trade negotiations that ended up forcing the Mexican government to cooperate on enforcement and not to cooperate on promoting a regional migration system that could be focused on people and not on trade.
We're going to end with an African migrant who took part in a recent protest outside an immigration office in Chiapas.
We're here. We're still here. It has been 10 days, and we're demanding to be given a pass to cross through Mexico. But there are no solutions. We are suffering repression from the police here. The National Guard is here beating us, kicking pregnant women and children.
Your final comment, Carolina Jimenez.
We really wish to see a debate on migration that is both efficient for governments, I mean, that understands a debate that takes into consideration that governments have needs and priorities, etc., but that is rights-based. If we could see countries cooperating in terms of human rights, when it comes to protecting people's human rights, the way we see countries and governments cooperating when it comes to enforcement, I think we will be in a much better place. Mexico has international obligations that it needs to fulfill when it comes to protecting people's rights to seek asylum and free movement.
Carolina Jimenez, I want to thank you so much for being with us, America's Deputy Director for Research at Amnesty International, speaking to us from Mexico City. When we come back, we look at the remarkable story of a Palestinian student who grew up in a Lebanese refugee camp, who was accepted to Harvard, then deported when he got to Logan Airport. Well, he's made it back, and we'll find out how. Stay with us.
نحتاج فينا النور في بالوطن أمل فينا بالتحرير
ننافس في حياتنا أصعب وضع فنشجد نكافح فساد ما نطمع بنستسلمش بنفوض الجريمة الطمع تسرق حقي وكرامتك بالمجتمع بدنا من زرع حصد ومن جد وجد مش من زرع ما حصد ومن جد لا يجد بدناش نقول مين بتعرف مش ايش بتعرف تبدا القصة من حقك انه لازم تعرف نشوف شاب ماخذ تخدير مش محصل انه يكون اي فرصة والتاني معاه واصلة مش بحاجة لتفسير وصل ابعد نقطة فليش نوسوس مخاخنا فن كون الغبا لنستغل قدرتنا فن كون السادة عنا قانوني حاسم محتاجين نطبقه
We have hope by revolution makers. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, today marks a week since a 17-year-old Palestinian student who was denied entry into the United States last month began classes with his fellow Harvard freshman. Ismail Ajawi was initially turned away at Boston's Logan Airport just under 3 weeks ago after immigration officials searched his phone and computer and interrogated him about his religion and social media posts by friends of his that were critical of U.S. policy. He was then forced to return home to Lebanon, but his case provoked outrage on the Harvard campus and among some Palestinian rights and academic freedom groups. Ajawi's family released a statement after he was admitted back into the U.S., thanking supporters. Harvard and the educational organization Amidist, the family said, quote, the last 10 days have been difficult and anxiety-filled, but we are most grateful for the thousands of messages of support and particularly the work of Amidist. We hope now that everyone can respect our and Ismail's privacy, and he can now simply focus on settling into college and his important classwork.
Ismail Ajawi, who is attending Harvard on a full scholarship, was educated in schools run by UNRWA. That's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine, which serves more than 500,000 Palestinian refugee children in over 700 schools. Ismail was featured in this 2019 UNRWA video for their Back to School campaign.
My name is Ismail Ajawi. I'm 17 years old. I scored the highest marks in biology in the South region in the official Lebanese baccalaureate and the 8th overall in Lebanon. I also scored the highest marks in the brevet examination in the South region and received a scholarship to study biophysics at Harvard University. I aim to double major and to study medicine in the future. The environment in school and in the camp is very challenging. Overpopulation is a big issue in the camp. The houses are too close to each other. In this atmosphere, there's no privacy for Palestinian students to study. Every year, these limited opportunities decrease. This is my school, the UNRWA Deir Yassin Secondary Boys School. The times I spent here were both tiring and fun. I tell my schoolmates to put a lot of effort into their studies and to work hard so that they can fulfill their dreams just like I did.
That was now Harvard freshman Ismail Ajawi, a Palestinian refugee educated in the UNRWA schools. Meanwhile, UNRWA itself is under threat after the Trump administration ended all U.S. funding for the program, a loss of about $360 million in annual funding and the organization's largest single contribution. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests. In Gaza, Matthias Schmula is with us, director of UNRWA operations in Gaza, and Theodore Khatouf, president and CEO of Amidist, the education training nonprofit that works in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Amidist helped Ismail Ajawi win a scholarship to Harvard University. Ambassador Khatouf is a former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates and then Syria. We're going to start with Matthias Schmala, director of UNRWA operations in Gaza. You're there in Gaza. Talk about this school that Ismail comes from.
Yes, good morning to you, and thank you for your interest in this story. Of course, the situation in Gaza is slightly different from the one in Lebanon where Ismail went to school, but we run the same school system. We have in Gaza now 276 schools, and in the school year that started about 2 weeks ago, we have 284,000 students like Ismail, wanting, hungry for a good education, and with dreams and hopes to maybe not all go to Harvard, of course, but to make something out of this education by continuing to study and finding opportunities like Ismail has just found.
And talk about the number of students in these schools. How unusual is Ismail's situation? I mean, he gets into school, he gets into Harvard, he comes to Logan Airport in Boston, and he is immediately deported. And amazingly, they said to him they had problems with the Facebook entries, not of Ismail himself, but of his friends.
Yeah, sadly, this is a situation in which most Palestine children, Palestine refugee children, find themselves in. So the situation is similar to that of Israel in that they have the benefit of getting an education through the United Nations, through the UNRWA schools I mentioned earlier, but similar also, sadly, in that the opportunities are far and few between in terms of getting out, in my case here in Gaza, out of the Gaza Strip and seizing opportunities of a scholarship. And there is another parallel that you alluded to, which is most of the children I meet, and I regularly visit our 276 schools here and talk to many of the students, many of the teachers. Many of the students are just normal children like you and I would have. I have three teenage sons. They have dreams. They are normal children. They sometimes get angry, but basically they just want to fulfill their dreams for a better life. And sometimes they get punished for association, let's say, because some friend has been discovered publishing something on their respective social media. So you will find, I find, quite a few kids who talk about this experience of, you know, not being taken in their own right on what they think and feel, but something a friend or a relative may have said. That is definitely a challenge that many of the Palestine refugees face.
Well, Ambassador Khatouf, you're the president and the CEO of Amadista. I'm wondering if you could talk about the role that your organization has played throughout the Middle East and the Arab world, and whether the young people that you're giving scholarships to, whether there's been any particular problems with the Palestinians, given especially the United States policy toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Yeah, sure. My organization's been around since 1951. We have 23 facilities spread across 11 countries and territories. We have five offices alone in occupied Palestine, including in Gaza City. We do many programs, but some of our programs are with the U.S. government, and they're U.S. government funded. And Ismail himself benefited from what are known as opportunity grants. That is, he went in Beirut to a competitive college club that helped coach him on how you apply to American university, how you can present yourself. He had to do, you know, he is a self-made man, but we had to teach him, you know, how to make himself, make Harvard and other schools aware of his abilities. We have 53 other Palestinians currently in the U.S. studying at the undergraduate level who've gone through similar programs. In fact, we have one young man in Gaza from beach camp going to Stanford this year. We have another woman from Gaza going to Smith College in Massachusetts. And I could go on. But the point is that this has not happened at the U.S. Points of entry. But it has happened. We have had problems in Gaza getting the kids out in past years. I believe the Israelis believe that the Palestinians in Gaza should get rid of Hamas. And when they couldn't or didn't, there was more or less mass punishment. So it was always a struggle every year to get our Gaza students out, including Fulbright scholars who are on U.S. graduate school scholarships. Eventually, they'd get out, but it was always a tussle. This year, I think the Israeli government decided, hey, if they want to leave Gaza, let them go.
So, Ambassador Khatouf, explain what happened with Ismail. Explain what happened when he got to the airport at Logan, why he was deported, and then how you got him back in to start with the freshman class.
Right. Well, you described it very well. It was a matter of his social media. The young man hardly ever posted anything himself. He's only 17 years old, but they go back 5 years. He has about 1,000 friends on Facebook, and yet he's not really active with them. They're classmates and the like. And it appears that the people at Boston Logan, the Customs and Border Patrol people, didn't like some of the postings of people that were allegedly friends of his. But that raises a much bigger question, of course, and that is intellectual thought. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech. What's the criteria? Nobody accused him of having any terrorist tendencies, any radical tendencies. So what are these people going to be judged on? Not just Ismail. The organization PEN issued a very strong statement over this matter.
And so what happened with the Harvard president?
Well, the Harvard president, President Bacow, was incredible. He showed tremendous empathy, tremendous support. He was in touch with Secretary of State Pompeo, Homeland Security Secretary Micheline, and the U.S. Embassy in Beirut was tremendous in turning this around. I hope I don't get them in trouble, but they did a great job because it was something called opportunity grants funneled through Amideast that allowed Ismail to have the financial wherewithal to apply to Harvard and other schools in the U.S., to take the kinds of tests you have to take, and then to get an airline ticket to the U.S. So it was the right hand of government and the left hand not knowing what each other was doing.
And I'd like to go back to Matthias Schmali on the whole issue of what UNRWA's role. You're educating more than 500,000 Palestinians in your schools, and yet at the same time now you're facing a cut from the Trump administration to UNRWA of $360 million. What's how big a hit is this, the Trump administration decision, and what's that going to do to your ability to provide a basic education?
Yeah, if I may start just with the dimensions here. Our annual budget for the five fields in which we work and in which we run our schools and primary health care centers is $1.2 billion. So if you then lose 360 million of that, that is a significant hit. How are we coping with that? Well, in 2018, last year, we had 42 countries and institutions like the EU jump in and give us additional money to the monies they have had planned for. So last year, towards the end of a very difficult year because of losing this money from the U.S. government, we actually broke even. And it was, from in that perspective, a success story. Now, we are like a government service. So each year, the budget starts again and the fundraising has to start again. And as we speak today, we still have a projected deficit of over $120 million. So, again, we continue feeling this hit of losing our biggest donor. And let me also say that, you know, there's huge appreciation here in Gaza. Many people may not believe this, for the U.S. investments over years, if not decades. A week ago or so, I opened one of our new schools here, one of our new schools in Gaza, and it was financed by the last grant we got from USAID for school construction. And there's a plaque at the entrance which says, built by U.S. money. And the children and the teachers and my staff here, we are very proud of this. And we regret very much that this investment into education and vital public services has ended. Now, we take the fact that Ismail got back into the U.S. to take his scholarship as one positive signal that there is a lot of solidarity beyond the government in the U.S., and that there is scope for continuing strong relationships and maybe at one point resuming also the financial support.
We're going to end with the voice of another young person. Democracy Now! Spoke to Hatan Hamduna in Gaza City yesterday. He's attended the UNRWA schools, a member of UNRWA's agency-wide student parliament.
I was born. I have lived through three wars, one at the age of four, another at the age of eight, and again at the age of 10. I have lived through the darkest moments, and the scenes of war and destructions are still in my head, haunting me in my sleep. During these darkest moments, UNRWA schools were my only hope for a successful future, as they provided us with education during emergencies. In spite of all these negative things in the Gaza Strip, I want the world to change this view and perception of the Gaza Strip. in spite of the closure of the Gaza Strip without water or electricity and the absence of freedom of all these negative things, I want you to know that Gaza is greater and a lot more than that, because children like myself in the Gaza Strip do not wish to be seen as victims, but rather as makers of change. In the future, I would like to become one of the best surgeons in the world. Education is the means for me to realize this dream and my aspirations. However, I sometimes feel afraid and concerned due to the shortage of job opportunities here in the Gaza Strip.
That's UNRWA student Hatem Hamduna speaking to us from Gaza City. That does it for this segment. We want to thank Matthias Schmuller, who is director of UNRWA operations in Gaza, speaking to us from there, and Theodore Khatouf, president and CEO of Amid East, who made Ismail Ajawi's his scholarship in Harvard. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.